2. Sabina was now by herself. She went back to the mirror, still in her underwear. She put the bowler hat back on her head and had a long look at herself. She was amazed at the number of years she had spent pursuing one lost moment. Once, during a visit to her studio many years before, the bowler hat had caught Tomas's fancy. He had set it on his head and looked at himself in the large mirror which, as in the Geneva studio, leaned against the wall. He wanted to see what he would have looked like as a 19th-century mayor. When Sabina started undressing, he put the hat on her head. There they stood in front of the mirror. They always stood in front of the mirror while she undressed, watching themselves. She stripped to her underwear, but still had the hat on her head. And all at once she realized they were both excited by what they saw in the mirror. What could have excited them so? A moment before, the hat on her head had seemed nothing but a joke. Was excitement really a mere step away from laughter? Yes. When they looked at each other in the mirror that time, all she saw for the first few seconds was a comic situation. But suddenly, the comic became veiled by excitement. The bowler hat no longer signified a joke. It signified violence. Violence against Sabina, against her dignity as a woman. She saw her bare legs and thin panties with her pubic triangle showing through. The lingerie enhanced the charm of her femininity, while the hard masculine hat denied it, violated and ridiculed it. The fact that Tomas stood beside her fully dressed meant that the essence of what they both saw was far from good, clean fun. If it had been fun he was after, he too would have had to strip down and don a bowler hat. It was humiliation. But instead of spurning it, she proudly, provocatively played it for all it was worth, as if submitting of her own will to public rape. And suddenly, unable to wait any longer, she pulled Tomas down to the floor. The bowler hat rolled under the table, and they began thrashing about on the rug at the foot of the mirror. But let us return to the bowler hat. First, it was a vague reminder of a forgotten grandfather, the mayor of a small Bohemian town during the 19th century. Second, it was a memento of her father. After the funeral, her brother appropriated all their parents' property. And she, refusing out of sovereign contempt to fight for her rights, announced sarcastically that she was taking the bowler hat as her sole inheritance. Third, it was a prop for her love games with Tomas. Fourth, it was a sign of her originality, which she consciously cultivated. She could not take much with her when she emigrated, and taking this bulky, impractical thing meant giving up other, more practical ones. Fifth, now that she was abroad, the hat was a sentimental object. When she went to visit Tomas in Zurich, she took it along and had it on her head when he opened the hotel room door. But then something she had not reckoned with happened. The hat, no longer jaunty or sexy, turned into a monument to time past. They were both touched. They made love as they never had before. This was no occasion for obscene games, for this meeting was not a continuation of their erotic rendezvous, each of which had been an opportunity to think up some new little vice. It was a recapitulation of time, a hymn to their common past, a sentimental summary of an unsentimental story that was disappearing in the distance. The bowler hat was a motif in the musical composition that was Sabina's life. It returned again and again, each time with a different meaning. And all the meanings flowed through the bowler hat like water through a riverbed. I might call it Heraclitus's, you can't step twice into the same river, riverbed. The bowler hat was a bed through which each time Sabina saw another river flow, another semantic river, each time the same object would give rise to a new meaning, though all former meanings would resonate, like an echo, like a parade of echoes, together with the new one. each new experience would resound, each time enriching the harmony. The reason why Tomas and Sabina were touched by the sight of the bowler hat in a Zurich hotel and made love almost in tears was that its black presence was not merely a reminder of their love games, but also a memento of Sabina's father and of her grandfather, who lived in a century without airplanes and cars. Now perhaps we are in a better position to understand the abyss separating Sabina and Franz. He listened eagerly to the story of her life, and she was equally eager to hear the story of his. But although they had a clear understanding of the logical meaning of the words they exchanged, they failed to hear the semantic susurrus of the river flowing through them. And so, when she put on the bowler hat in his presence, Franz felt uncomfortable, as if someone had spoken to him in a language he did not know. It was neither obscene nor sentimental, merely an incomprehensible gesture. What made him feel uncomfortable was its very lack of meaning. While people are fairly young and the musical composition of their lives is still in its opening bars, they can go about writing it together and exchange motifs the way Tomas and Sabina exchange the motif of the bowler hat. But if they meet when they are older, like Franz and Sabina, their musical compositions are more or less complete. And every motif, every object, every word means something different to each of them. If I were to make a record of all Sabina and Franz's conversations, I could compile a long lexicon of their misunderstandings. Let us be content instead with a short dictionary. 3. A short dictionary of misunderstood words. Woman. Being a woman is a fate Sabina did not choose. What we have not chosen, we cannot consider either our merit or our failure. Sabina believed she had to assume the correct attitude to her unchosen fate. To rebel against being born a woman seemed as foolish to her as to take pride in it. During one of their first times together, Franz announced to her in an oddly emphatic way, "Sabina, you are a woman." She could not understand why he accentuated the obvious with the solemnity of a Columbus who had just sighted land. Not until later did she understand that the word woman, on which he had placed such uncommon emphasis, did not, in his eyes, signify one of the two human sexes. It represented a value. Not every woman was worthy of being called a woman. But if Sabina was, in Franz's eyes, a woman, then what was his wife, Marie Claude? More than 20 years earlier, several months after Franz met Marie Claude, she had threatened to take her life if he abandoned her. Franz was bewitched by the threat. He was not particularly fond of Marie Claude, but he was very much taken with her love. He felt himself unworthy of so great a love and felt he owed her a low bow. He bowed so low that he married her. And even though Marie Claude never recaptured the emotional intensity that accompanied her suicide threat, in his heart he kept its memory alive with the thought that he must never hurt her and always respect the woman in her. It is an interesting formulation. Not respect Marie Claude, but respect the woman in Marie Claude. But if Marie Claude is herself a woman, then who is that other woman hiding in her, the one he must always respect? The platonic ideal of a woman, perhaps? No. His mother. It never would have occurred to him to say he respected the woman in his mother. He worshipped his mother, and not some woman inside her. His mother and the platonic ideal of womanhood were one and the same. When he was 12, she suddenly found herself alone, abandoned by Franz's father. The boy suspected something serious had happened, but his mother muted the drama with mild, insipid words so as not to upset him. The day his father left, Franz and his mother went into town together, and as they left home, Franz noticed that her shoes did not match. He was in a quandary. He wanted to point out her mistake, but was afraid he would hurt her. So during the 2 hours they spent walking through the city together, he kept his eyes fixed on her feet. It was then he had his first inkling of what it means to suffer. Fidelity and Betrayal. He loved her from the time he was a child until the time he accompanied her to the cemetery. He loved her in his memories as well. That is what made him feel that fidelity deserved pride of place among the virtues. Fidelity gave a unity to lives that would otherwise splinter into thousands of split-second impressions. Franz often spoke about his mother to Sabina, perhaps even with a certain unconscious ulterior motive. He assumed that Sabina would be charmed by his ability to be faithful, that it would win her over. What he did not know was that Sabina was charmed more by betrayal than by fidelity. The word fidelity reminded her of her father, a small-town Puritan who spent his Sundays painting away at canvases of woodland sunsets and roses in vases. Thanks to him, she started drawing as a child. When she was 14, she fell in love with a boy her age. Her father was so frightened that he would not let her out of the house by herself for a year. One day, he showed her some Picasso reproductions and made fun of them. If she couldn't love her 14-year-old schoolboy, she could at least love Cubism. After completing school, she went off to Prague with the euphoric feeling that now, at last, she could betray her home. Betrayal. From tender youth, we are told by father and teacher that betrayal is the most heinous offense imaginable. But what is betrayal? Betrayal means breaking ranks. Betrayal means breaking ranks and going off into the unknown. Sabina knew of nothing more magnificent than going off into the unknown. Though a student at the Academy of Fine Arts, she was not allowed to paint like Picasso. It was the period when so-called socialist realism was prescribed, and the school manufactured portraits of communist statesmen. Her longing to betray her father remained unsatisfied. Communism was merely another father, a father equally strict and limited, a father who forbade her love, the times were puritanical, and Picasso, too. And if she married a second-rate actor, it was only because he had a reputation for being eccentric and was unacceptable to both fathers. Then her mother died. The day following her return to Prague from the funeral, she received a telegram saying that her father had taken his life out of grief. Suddenly she felt pangs of conscience. Was it really so terrible that her father had painted vases filled with roses and hated Picasso? Was it really so reprehensible that he was afraid of his 14-year-old daughter's coming home pregnant? Was it really so laughable that he could not go on living without his wife? And again she felt a longing to betray. Betray her own betrayal. She announced to her husband, whom she now considered a difficult drunk rather than an eccentric, that she was leaving him. But if we betray B, for whom we betrayed A, it does not necessarily follow that we have placated A. The life of a divorcee painter did not in the least resemble the life of the parents she had betrayed. The first betrayal is irreparable. It calls forth a chain reaction of further betrayals, each of which takes us farther and farther away from the point of our original betrayal. Music. For Franz, music was the art that comes closest to Dionysian beauty in the sense of intoxication. No one can get really drunk on a novel or a painting, but who can help getting drunk on Beethoven's Ninth, Bartok's Sonata for Two Pianos and Percussion, or the Beatles' White Album? Franz made no distinction between classical music and pop. He found the distinction old-fashioned and hypocritical. He loved rock as much as Mozart. He considered music a liberating force. It liberated him from loneliness, introversion, the dust of the library. It opened the door of his body and allowed his soul to step out into the world to make friends. He loved to dance and regretted that Sabina did not share his passion. They were sitting together at a restaurant, and loud music with a heavy beat poured out of a nearby speaker as they ate. "It's a vicious circle," Sabina said. "People are going deaf because music is played louder and louder. But because they're going deaf, it has to be played louder still.
Don't you like music? Franz asked.
No, said Sabina, and then added, though in a different era, she was thinking of the days of Johann Sebastian Bach, when music was like a rose blooming on a boundless, snow-covered plain of silence. Noise, masked as music, had pursued her since early childhood. During her years at the Academy of Fine Arts, students had been required to spend whole summer vacations at a youth camp. They lived in common quarters and worked together on a steelworks construction site. Music roared out of loudspeakers on the site from 5 in the morning to 9 at night. She felt like crying, but the music was cheerful, and there was nowhere to hide, not in the latrine or under the bedclothes. Everything was in range of the speakers. The music was like a pack of hounds that had been sicked on her. At the time, she had thought that only in the communist world could such musical barbarism reign supreme. Abroad, she discovered that the transformation of music into noise was a planetary process, by which mankind was entering the historical phase of total ugliness. The total ugliness to come had made itself felt first as omnipresent acoustical ugliness. Cars, motorcycles, electric guitars, drills, loudspeakers, sirens. The omnipresence of visual ugliness would soon follow. After dinner, they went upstairs to their room and made love. And as Franz fell asleep, his thoughts began to lose coherence. He recalled the noisy music at dinner and said to himself, "Noise has one advantage. It drowns out words." And suddenly he realized that all his life he had done nothing but talk, write, lecture, concoct sentences, search for formulations and amend them. So, in the end, no words were precise. Their meanings were obliterated. Their content lost, they turned into trash, chaff, dust, sand, prowling through his brain, tearing at his head. They were his insomnia, his illness. And what he yearned for at that moment, vaguely but with all his might, was unbounded music, absolute sound, a pleasant and happy, all-encompassing, overpowering, window-rattling din to engulf, once and for all, the pain, the futility, the vanity of words. Music was the negation of sentences. Music was the anti-word. He yearned for one long embrace with Sabina, yearned never to say another sentence, another word, to let his orgasm fuse with the orgiastic thunder of music. And lulled by that blissful imaginary uproar, he fell asleep. Light and darkness. Living for Sabina meant seeing. Seeing is limited by two borders, strong light, which blinds, and total darkness. Perhaps that was what motivated Sabina's distaste for all extremism. Extremes mean borders beyond which life ends, and a passion for extremism in art and in politics is a veiled longing for death. In Franz, the word light did not evoke the picture of a landscape basking in the soft glow of day. It evoked the source of light itself, the sun, a light bulb, a spotlight. Franz's associations were familiar metaphors. The sun of righteousness, the lambent flame of the intellect, and so on. Darkness attracted him as much as light. He knew that these days turning out the light before making love was considered laughable, and so he always left a small lamp burning over the bed. At the moment he penetrated Sabina, however, he closed his eyes. The pleasure suffusing his body called for darkness. That darkness was pure, perfect, thoughtless, visionless. That darkness was without end, without borders. That darkness was the infinite we each carry within us. Yes, if you're looking for infinity, just close your eyes. And at the moment he felt pleasure suffusing his body, Franz himself disintegrated and dissolved into the infinity of his darkness, himself becoming infinite. But the larger a man grows in his own inner darkness, the more his outer form diminishes. A man with closed eyes is a wreck of a man. Then, Sabina found the sight of Franz distasteful. and to avoid looking at him, she too closed her eyes. But for her, darkness did not mean infinity. For her, it meant a disagreement with what she saw, the negation of what was seen, the refusal to see. 4. Sabina once allowed herself to be taken along to a gathering of fellow emigres. As usual, they were hashing over whether they should or should not have taken up arms against the Russians. In the safety of emigration, they all naturally came out in favor of fighting. Sabina said, "Then why don't you go back and fight?" That was not the thing to say. A man with artificially waved gray hair pointed a long index finger at her. "That's no way to talk. You're all responsible for what happened. You, too. How did you oppose the communist regime? All you did was paint pictures." Assessing the populace, checking up on it, is a principal and never-ending social activity in communist countries. If a painter is to have an exhibition, an ordinary citizen to receive a visa to a country with a seacoast, a soccer player to join the national team, then a vast array of recommendations and reports must be garnered from the concierge, colleagues, the police, the local party organization, the pertinent trade union, and added up, weighed, and summarized by special officials. These reports have nothing to do with artistic talent, kicking ability, or melodies that respond well to salt sea air. They deal with one thing only, the citizen's political profile. In other words, what the citizen says, what he thinks, how he behaves, how he acquits himself at meetings or May Day parades. Because everything, day-to-day existence, promotion at work, vacations, depends on the outcome of the assessment process, everyone, whether he wants to play soccer for the national team, have an exhibition, or spend his holidays at the seaside, must behave in such a way as to deserve a favorable assessment. That was what ran through Sabina's mind as she listened to the gray-haired man speak. He didn't care whether his fellow countrymen were good kickers or painters. None of the Czechs at the emigre gathering ever showed any interest in what Sabina painted. He cared whether they had opposed communism actively or just passively, really and truly, or just for appearance's sake, from the very beginning or just since emigration. Because she was a painter, she had an eye for detail and a memory for the physical characteristics of the people in Prague who had a passion for assessing others. All of them had index fingers slightly longer than their middle fingers and pointed them at whomever they happened to be talking to. In fact, President Novotny, who had ruled the country for the 14 years preceding 1968, sported the very same barber-induced gray waves and had the longest index finger of all the inhabitants of Central Europe. When the distinguished émigré heard from the lips of a painter whose pictures he had never seen that he resembled Communist President Novotny, he turned scarlet, then white, then scarlet again, then white once more. He tried to say something, did not succeed, and fell silent. Everyone else kept silent until Sabina stood up and left. It made her unhappy, and down in the street she asked herself why she should bother to maintain contact with Czechs. What bound her to them? The landscape? If each of them were asked to say what the name of his native country evoked in him, the images that came to mind would be so different as to rule out all possibility of unity. Or the culture. But what was that? Music? Dvořák and Janáček? Yes. But what if a Czech had no feeling for music? Then the essence of being Czech vanished into thin air. Or great men? Jan Hus? None of the people in that room had ever read a line of his works. The only thing they were all able to understand was the flames, the glory of the flames when he was burned at the stake, the glory of the ashes, so for them the essence of being Czech came down to ashes and nothing more. The only things that held them together were their defeats and the reproaches they addressed to one another. She was walking fast. She was more disturbed by her own thoughts than by her break with the émigrés. She knew she was being unfair. There were other Czechs, after all, people quite different from the man with the long index finger. The embarrassed silence that followed her little speech did not by any means indicate they were all against her, no. They were probably bewildered by the sudden hatred, the lack of understanding they were all subjected to in emigration. Then why wasn't she sorry for them? Why didn't she see them for the woeful and abandoned creatures they were? We know why. After she betrayed her father, life opened up before her, a long road of betrayals, each one attracting her as vice and victory. She would not keep ranks. She refused to keep ranks, always with the same people, with the same speeches. That was why she was so stirred by her own injustice. But it was not an unpleasant feeling, quite the contrary. Sabina had the impression she had just scored a victory, and someone, invisible, was applauding her for it. Then suddenly the intoxication gave way to anguish. The road had to end somewhere. Sooner or later, she would have to put an end to her betrayals. Sooner or later, she would have to stop herself. It was evening, and she was hurrying through the railway station. The train to Amsterdam was in. She found her coach. Guided by a friendly guard, she opened the door to her compartment and found Franz sitting on a couchette. He rose to greet her. She threw her arms around him and smothered him with kisses. She had an overwhelming desire to tell him, like the most banal of women, "Don't let me go. Hold me tight. Make me your plaything, your slave. Be strong." But there were words she could not say. The only thing she said when he released her from his embrace was, "You don't know how happy I am to be with you." That was the most her reserved nature allowed her to express. 5. A Short Dictionary of Misunderstood Words, continued. Parades. People in Italy or France have it easy. When their parents force them to go to church, they get back at them by joining the party, communist, Maoist, Trotskyist, etc. Sabina, however, was first sent to church by her father, then forced by him to attend meetings of the Communist Youth League. He was afraid of what would happen if she stayed away. When she marched in the obligatory May Day parades, she could never keep in step, and the girl behind her would shout at her and purposely tread on her heels. When the time came to sing, she never knew the words of the songs and would merely open and close her mouth. But the other girls would notice and report her. From her youth on, she hated parades. Franz had studied in Paris, and because he was extraordinarily gifted, his scholarly career was assured from the time he was 20. At 20, he knew he would live out his life within the confines of his university office, one or two libraries, and two or three lecture halls. The idea of such a life made him feel suffocated. He yearned to step out of his life the way one steps out of a house into the street. And so long as he lived in Paris, he took part in every possible demonstration. How nice it was to celebrate something, demand something, protest against something, to be out in the open, to be with others. The parades filing down the Boulevard Saint-Germain or from the Place de la République to the Bastille fascinated him. He saw the marching, shouting crowd as the image of Europe and its history. Europe was the Grand March, the march from revolution to revolution, from struggle to struggle, ever onward. I might put it another way. Franz felt his book life to be unreal. He yearned for real life, for the touch of people walking side by side with him, for their shouts. It never occurred to him that what he considered unreal, the work he did in the solitude of the office or library, was in fact his real life, whereas the parades he imagined to be reality were nothing but theater, dance, carnivals, in other words, a dream. During her studies, Sabina lived in a dormitory. On May Day, all the students had to report early in the morning for the parade. Student officials would comb the building to ensure that no one was missing. Sabina hid in the lavatory. Not until long after the building was empty would she go back to her room. It was quieter than anywhere she could remember. The only sound was the parade music echoing in the distance. It was as though she had found refuge inside a shell, and the only sound she could hear was the sea of an inimical world. A year or two after emigrating, she happened to be in Paris on the anniversary of the Russian invasion of her country. A protest march had been scheduled, and she felt driven to take part. Fists raised high, the young Frenchman shouted out slogans condemning Soviet imperialism. She liked the slogans, but to her surprise, she found herself unable to shout along with them. She lasted no more than a few minutes in the parade. When she told her French friends about it, they were amazed. "You mean you don't want to fight the occupation of your country?" She would have liked to tell them that behind communism, fascism, behind all occupations and invasion, lurks a more basic, pervasive evil, and that the image of that evil was a parade of people marching by with raised fists and shouting identical syllables in unison. But she knew she would never be able to make them understand. Embarrassed, she changed the subject. The Beauty of New York. Franz and Sabina would walk the streets of New York for hours at a time. The view changed with each step, as if they were following a winding mountain path surrounded by breathtaking scenery. A young man kneeling in the middle of the sidewalk praying. A few steps away, a beautiful black woman leaning against a tree. A man in a black suit directing an invisible orchestra while crossing the street. A fountain spurting water and a group of construction workers sitting on the rim eating lunch. Strange iron ladders running up and down buildings with ugly red facades, so ugly that they were beautiful. And next door, a huge glass skyscraper backed by another, itself topped by a small Arabian pleasure dome with turrets, galleries, and gilded columns. She was reminded of her paintings. There, too, incongruous things came together. A steelworks construction site superimposed on a kerosene lamp. An old-fashioned lamp with a painted glass shade shattered into tiny splinters and rising up over a desolate landscape of marshland. Franz said, "Beauty in the European sense has always had a premeditated quality to it. We've always had an aesthetic intention and a long-range plan. That's what enabled Western man to spend decades building a Gothic cathedral or a Renaissance piazza. The beauty of New York rests on a completely different base. It's unintentional. It arose independent of human design, like a stalagmitic cavern. Forms which are in themselves quite ugly turn up fortuitously, without design, in such incredible surroundings that they sparkle with a sudden, wondrous poetry." Sabina said, "Unintentional beauty, yes. Another way of putting it might be beauty by mistake. Before beauty disappears entirely from the earth, it will go on existing for a while by mistake. Beauty by mistake, the final phase in the history of beauty." And she recalled her first mature painting, which came into being because some red paint had dripped on it by mistake. Yes, her paintings were based on beauty by mistake, and New York was the secret but authentic homeland of her painting. Franz said, "Perhaps New York's unintentional beauty is much richer and more varied than the excessively strict and composed beauty of human design. But it's not our European beauty. It's an alien world." Didn't they then at last agree on something? No, there is a difference. Sabina was very much attracted by the alien quality of New York's beauty. Franz found it intriguing but frightening. It made him feel homesick for Europe. Sabina's country. Sabina understood Franz's distaste for America. He was the embodiment of Europe. His mother was Viennese, his father French, and he himself was Swiss. Franz greatly admired Sabina's country. Whenever she told him about herself and her friends from home, Franz heard the words prison, persecution, enemy tanks, emigration, pamphlets, banned books, banned exhibitions, and he felt a curious mixture of envy and nostalgia. He made a confession to Sabina. "A philosopher once wrote that everything in my work is unverifiable speculation,
and called me a pseudo-Socrates. I felt terribly humiliated and made a furious response. And just think, that laughable episode was the greatest conflict I've ever experienced. The pinnacle of the dramatic possibilities available to my life. We live in two different dimensions, you and I. You came into my life like Gulliver, entering the land of the Lilliputians. Sabina protested. She said that conflict, drama, and tragedy didn't mean a thing. There was nothing inherently valuable in them, nothing deserving of respect or admiration. What was truly enviable was Franz's work, and the fact that he had the peace and quiet to devote himself to it. Franz shook his head. When a society is rich, its people don't need to work with their hands. They can devote themselves to activities of the spirit. We have more and more universities and more students. If students are going to earn degrees, they've got to come up with dissertation topics. And since dissertations can be written about everything under the sun, the number of topics is infinite. Sheets of paper covered with words pile up in archives, sadder than cemeteries, because no one ever visits them, not even on All Souls' Day. Culture is perishing in overproduction, in an avalanche of words, in the madness of quantity. That's why one banned book in your former country means infinitely more than the billions of words spewed out by our universities. It is in this spirit that we may understand Franz's weakness for revolution. First, he sympathized with Cuba, then with China, and when the cruelty of their regimes began to appall him, he resigned himself with a sigh to a sea of words with no weight and no resemblance to life. He became a professor in Geneva, where there are no demonstrations, and in a burst of abnegation, in womanless, paradeless solitude, he published several scholarly books, all of which received considerable acclaim. Then one day along came Sabina. She was a revelation. She came from a land where revolutionary illusion had long since faded, but where the thing he admired most in revolution remained. Life on a large scale. A life of risk, daring, and the danger of death. Sabina had renewed his faith in the grandeur of human endeavor. Superimposing the painful drama of her country on her person, he found her even more beautiful. The trouble was that Sabina had no love for that drama. The words prison, persecution, banned books, occupation, tanks were ugly, without the slightest trace of romance. The only word that evoked in her a sweet, nostalgic memory of her homeland was the word cemetery. Cemetery. Cemeteries in Bohemia are like gardens. The graves are covered with grass and colorful flowers. Modest tombstones are lost in the greenery. When the sun goes down, the cemetery sparkles with tiny candles. It looks as though the dead are dancing at a children's ball. Yes, a children's ball, because the dead are as innocent as children. No matter how brutal life becomes, peace always reigns in the cemetery. Even in wartime, in Hitler's time, in Stalin's time, through all occupations. When she felt low, she would get into the car, leave Prague far behind, and walk through one or another of the country cemeteries she loved so well. Against a backdrop of blue hills, they were as beautiful as a lullaby. For Franz, a cemetery was an ugly dump of stones and bones. 6. I'd never drive. I'm scared stiff of accidents. Even if they don't kill you, they mark you for life. And so saying, the sculptor made an instinctive grab for the finger he had nearly chopped off one day while whittling away at a wood statue. It was a miracle the finger had been saved. "What do you mean?" said Marie Claude in a raucous voice. She was in top form. "I was in a serious accident once, and I wouldn't have missed it for the world, and I've never had more fun than when I was in the hospital. I couldn't sleep a wink, so I just read and read day and night." They all looked at her in amazement. She basked in it. Franz reacted with a mixture of disgust. He knew that after the accident in question, his wife had fallen into a deep depression and complained incessantly. And admiration, Her ability to transform everything she experienced was a sign of true vitality. "It was there I began to divide books into day books and night books," she went on. "Really, there are books meant for daytime reading and books that can be read only at night." Now they all looked at her in amazement and admiration, all, that is, but the sculptor, who was still holding his finger and wrinkling his face at the memory of the accident. Marie Claude turned to him and asked, "Which category would you put Stendhal in?" The sculptor had not heard the question and shrugged his shoulders uncomfortably. An art critic standing next to him said he thought of Stendhal as daytime reading. Marie Claude shook her head and said in her raucous voice, "No, no, you're wrong, you're wrong. Stendhal is a night author." Franz's participation in the debate on night art and day art was disturbed by the fact that he was expecting Sabina to show up at any minute. They had spent many days pondering whether or not she should accept the invitation to this cocktail party. It was a party Marie Claude was giving for all painters and sculptors who had ever exhibited in her private gallery. Ever since Sabina had met Franz, she had avoided his wife. But because they feared being found out, they came to the conclusion that it would be more natural and therefore less suspicious for her to come. While throwing unobtrusive looks in the direction of the entrance hall, Franz heard his 18-year-old daughter, Marie Anne, holding forth at the other end of the room. Excusing himself from the group presided over by his wife, he made his way to the group presided over by his daughter. Some were in chairs, others standing, but Marie Anne was cross-legged on the floor. Franz was certain that Marie Claude would soon switch to the carpet on her side of the room, too. Sitting on the floor when you had guests was at the time a gesture signifying simplicity, informality, liberal politics, hospitality, and a Parisian way of life. The passion with which Marie Claude sat on all floors was such that Franz began to worry she would take to sitting on the floor of the shop where she bought her cigarettes. "What are you working on now, Alain?" Marie Anne asked the man at whose feet she was sitting. Alain was so naive and sincere as to try to give the gallery owner's daughter an honest answer. He started explaining his new approach to her, a combination of photography and oil, but he had scarcely got through three sentences when Marie Anne began whistling a tune. The painter was speaking slowly and with great concentration and did not hear the whistling. "Will you tell me why you're whistling?" Franz whispered. "Because I don't like to hear people talk about politics," she answered out loud. And, in fact, two men standing in the same circle were discussing the coming elections in France. Marie Anne, who felt it her duty to direct the proceedings, asked the men whether they were planning to go to the Rossini Opera an Italian company was putting on in Geneva the following week. Meanwhile, Alain the painter sank into greater and greater detail about his new approach to painting. Franz was ashamed for his daughter. To put her in her place, he announced that whenever she went to the opera, she complained terribly of boredom. "You're awful," said Marie Anne, trying to punch him in the stomach from a sitting position. "The star tenor is so handsome, so handsome. I've seen him twice now, and I'm in love with him." Franz could not get over how much like her mother his daughter was. Why couldn't she be like him? But there was nothing he could do about it. She was not like him. How many times had he heard Marie Claude proclaim she was in love with this or that painter, singer, writer, politician, and even once with a racing cyclist? Of course, it was all mere cocktail party rhetoric, but he could not help recalling now and then that more than 20 years ago she had gone about saying the same thing about him, and threatening him with suicide to boot. At that point, Sabina entered the room. Marie Claude walked up to her. While Marie Anne went on about Rossini, Franz trained his attention on what the two women were saying. After a few friendly words of greeting, Marie Claude lifted the ceramic pendant from Sabina's neck and said in a very loud voice, "What is that? How ugly!" Those words made a deep impression on Franz. They were not meant to be combative. The raucous laughter immediately following them made it clear that by rejecting the pendant, Marie Claude did not wish to jeopardize her friendship with Sabina. But it was not the kind of thing she usually said. I made it myself, said Sabina. That pendant is ugly, really, Marie-Claude repeated very loudly. You shouldn't wear it. Franz knew his wife didn't care whether the pendant was ugly or not. An object was ugly if she willed it ugly, beautiful if she willed it beautiful. Pendants worn by her friends were a priori beautiful, and even if she did find them ugly, she would never say so, because flattery had long since become second nature to her. Why, then, did she decide that the pendant Sabina had made herself was ugly? Franz suddenly saw the answer plainly. Marie Claude proclaimed Sabina's pendant ugly because she could afford to do so. Or, to be more precise, Marie Claude proclaimed Sabina's pendant ugly to make it clear that she could afford to tell Sabina her pendant was ugly. Sabina's exhibition the year before had not been particularly successful, so Marie Claude did not set great store by Sabina's favor. Sabina, however, had every reason to set store by Marie Claude's. Yet that was not at all evident from her behavior. Yes, Franz saw it plainly. Marie Claude had taken advantage of the occasion to make clear to Sabina and others what the real balance of power was between the two of them. 7. A Short Dictionary of Misunderstood Words, concluded. The Old Church in Amsterdam. There are houses running along one side of the street, and behind the large ground-floor shop-front windows, all the whores have little rooms and plushly pillowed armchairs in which they sit up close to the glass, wearing bras and panties. They look like big, bored cats. On the other side of the street is a gigantic Gothic cathedral dating from the 14th century. Between the whore's world and God's world, like a river dividing two empires, stretches an intense smell of urine. Inside the old church, all that is left of the Gothic style is the high, bare, white walls, the columns, the vaulting, and the windows. There is not a single image on the walls, not a single piece of statuary anywhere. The church is as empty as a gymnasium, except in the very center, where several rows of chairs have been arranged in a large square around a miniature podium for the minister. Behind the chairs are wooden booths, stalls for wealthy burghers. The chairs and stalls seem to have been placed there without the slightest concern for the shape of the walls or position of the columns, as if wishing to express their indifference to or disdain for Gothic architecture. Centuries ago, Calvinist faith turned the cathedral into a hangar, its only function being to keep the prayers of the faithful safe from rain and snow. Franz was fascinated by it. The grand march of history had passed through this gigantic hall. Sabina recalled how after the communist coup, all the castles in Bohemia were nationalized and turned into manual training centers, retirement homes, and also cow sheds. She had visited one of the cow sheds. Hooks for iron rings had been hammered into the stucco walls, and cows tied to the rings gazed dreamily out of the windows at the castle grounds, now overrun with chickens. "It's the emptiness of it that fascinates me," said Franz. "People collect altars, statues, paintings, chairs, carpets, and books, and then comes a time of joyful relief, and they throw it all out like so much refuse from yesterday's dinner table. Can't you just picture Hercules' broom sweeping out this cathedral?" "The poor had to stand, while the rich had stalls," said Sabina, pointing to them. "But there was something that bound the bankers to beggars, a hatred of beauty." "What is beauty?" said Franz, and he saw himself attending a recent gallery preview at his wife's side, and at her insistence. The endless vanity of speeches and words, the vanity of culture, the vanity of art. When Sabina was working in the student brigade, her soul poisoned by the cheerful marches issuing incessantly from the loudspeakers, she borrowed a motorcycle one Sunday and headed for the hills. She stopped at a tiny remote village she had never seen before, leaned the motorcycle against the church, and went in. A mass happened to be in progress. Religion was persecuted by the regime, and most people gave the church a wide berth. The only people in the pews were old men and old women,
because they did not fear the regime. They feared only death. The priest intoned words in a sing-song voice, and the people repeated them after him in unison. It was a litany. The same words kept coming back, like a wanderer who cannot tear his eyes away from the countryside, or like a man who cannot take leave of his life. She sat in one of the last pews, closing her eyes, to hear the music of the words, opening them to stare up at the blue vault, dotted with large gold stars. She was entranced. What she had unexpectedly met there in the village church was not God. It was beauty. She knew perfectly well that neither the church nor the litany was beautiful in and of itself. But they were beautiful compared to the construction site, where she spent her days amid the racket of the songs. The Mass was beautiful because it appeared to her in a sudden, mysterious revelation as a world betrayed. From that time on, she had known that beauty is a world betrayed. The only way we can encounter it is if its persecutors have overlooked it somewhere. Beauty hides behind the scenes of the May Day parade. If we want to find it, we must demolish the scenery.
"This is the first time I've ever been fascinated by a church," said Franz.
It was neither Protestantism nor asceticism that made him so enthusiastic. It was something else, something highly personal, something he did not dare discuss with Sabina. He thought he heard a voice telling him to seize Hercules' broom and sweep all of Marie-Claude's previews, all of Marie-Anne's singers, all lectures and symposia, all useless speeches and vain words, sweep them out of his life. The great empty space of Amsterdam's old church had appeared to him in a sudden and mysterious revelation as the image of his own liberation. Strength. Stroking Franz's arms in bed in one of the many hotels where they made love, Sabina said, "The muscles you have, they're unbelievable." Franz took pleasure in her praise. He climbed out of bed, got down on his haunches, grabbed a heavy oak chair by one leg, and lifted it slowly into the air. "You never have to be afraid," he said. "I can protect you no matter what. I used to be a judo champion." When he raised the hand with the heavy chair above his head, Sabina said, "It's good to know you're so strong." But deep down, she said to herself, "Franz may be strong, but his strength is directed outward. When it comes to the people he lives with, the people he loves, he's weak. Franz's weakness is called goodness." Franz would never give Sabina orders. He would never command her, as Tomas had, to lay the mirror on the floor and walk back and forth on it naked. Not that he lacks sensuality, he simply lacks the strength to give orders. There are things that can be accomplished only by violence. Physical love is unthinkable without violence. Sabina watched Franz walk across the room with the chair above his head. The scene struck her as grotesque and filled her with an odd sadness. Franz set the chair down on the floor opposite Sabina and sat in it. "I enjoy being strong, of course," he said. "But what good do these muscles do me in Geneva? They're like an ornament, a peacock feather. I've never fought anyone in my life." Sabina proceeded with her melancholy musings. What if she had a man who ordered her about? A man who wanted to master her? How long would she put up with him? Not 5 minutes. From which it follows that no man was right for her, strong or weak. "Why don't you ever use your strength on me?" she said. "Because love means renouncing strength," said Franz softly. Sabina realized two things. First, that Franz's words were noble and just. Second, that they disqualified him from her love life. Living in Truth. Such is the formula set forth by Kafka somewhere in the diaries or letters. Franz couldn't quite remember where, but it captivated him. What does it mean to live in truth? Putting it negatively is easy enough. It means not lying, not hiding, and not dissimulating. From the time he met Sabina, however, Franz had been living in lies. He told his wife about non-existent congresses in Amsterdam and lectures in Madrid. He was afraid to walk with Sabina through the streets of Geneva, and he enjoyed the lying and hiding. It was all so new to him. He was as excited as a teacher's pet who has plucked up the courage to play truant. For Sabina, living in truth, lying neither to ourselves nor to others, was possible only away from the public. The moment someone keeps an eye on what we do, we involuntarily make allowances for that eye, and nothing we do is truthful. Having a public, keeping a public in mind, means living in lies. Sabina despised literature, in which people give away all kinds of intimate secrets about themselves and their friends. A man who loses his privacy loses everything, Sabina thought. And a man who gives it up of his own free will is a monster. That was why Sabina did not suffer in the least from having to keep her love secret. On the contrary, only by doing so could she live in truth. Franz, on the other hand, was certain that the division of life into private and public spheres is the source of all lies. A person is one thing in private and something quite different in public. For Franz, living in truth meant breaking down the barriers between the private and the public. He was fond of quoting André Breton on the desirability of living in a glass house, into which everyone can look and there are no secrets. When he heard his wife telling Sabina, "That pendant is ugly," he knew he could no longer live in lies and had to stand up for Sabina. He had not done so only because he was afraid of betraying their secret love. The day after the cocktail party, he was supposed to go to Rome with Sabina for the weekend. He could not get "that pendant is ugly" out of his mind, and it made him see Marie Claude in a completely new light. Her aggressiveness, invulnerable, noisy, and full of vitality, relieved him of the burden of goodness he had patiently borne all 23 years of their marriage. He recalled the enormous inner space of the old church in Amsterdam, and felt the strange, incomprehensible ecstasy that void had evoked in him. He was packing his overnight bag when Marie Claude came into the room, chatting about the guests at the party, energetically endorsing the views of some and laughing off the views of others. Franz looked at her for a long time and said, "There isn't any conference in Rome." She did not see the point. "Then why are you going?" "I've had a mistress for 9 months," he said. "I don't want to meet her in Geneva. That's why I've been traveling so much. I thought it was time you knew about it." After the first few words, he lost his nerve. He turned away so as not to see the despair on Marie Claude's face, the despair he expected his words to produce. After a short pause, he heard her say, "Yes, I think it's time I knew about it." Her voice was so firm that Franz turned in her direction. She did not look at all disturbed. In fact, she looked like the very same woman who had said the day before, in a raucous voice, "That pendant is ugly." She continued, "Now that you've plucked up the courage to tell me you've been deceiving me for 9 months, do you think you can tell me who she is?" He had always told himself he had no right to hurt Marie Claude and should respect the woman in her. But where had the woman in her gone? In other words, what had happened to the mother image he mentally linked with his wife? His mother, sad and wounded, his mother, wearing unmatched shoes, had departed from Marie Claude. Or perhaps not. Perhaps she had never been inside Marie Claude at all. The whole thing came to him in a flash of hatred. "I have no reason to hide it from you," he said. If he had not succeeded in wounding her with his infidelity, he was certain the revelation of her rival would do the trick. Looking her straight in the eye, he told her about Sabina. A while later, he met Sabina at the airport. As the plane gained altitude, he felt lighter and lighter. At last, he said to himself, after 9 months, he was living in truth. 8. Sabina felt as though Franz had pried open the door of their privacy, as though she were peering into the heads of Marie Claude, of Marie Anne, of Alain the painter, of the sculptor who held onto his finger, of all the people she knew in Geneva. Now she would willy-nilly become the rival of a woman who did not interest her in the least. Franz would ask for a divorce, and she would take Marie-Claude's place in his large conjugal bed. Everyone would follow the process from a greater or lesser distance, and she would be forced to play-act before them all. Instead of being Sabina, she would have to act the role of Sabina, decide how best to act the role. Once her love had been publicized, it would gain weight, become a burden. Sabina cringed at the very thought of it. They had supper at a restaurant in Rome. She drank her wine in silence.
"You're not angry, are you?" Franz asked.
She assured him she was not. She was still confused and unsure whether to be happy or not. She recalled the time they met in the sleeping compartment of the Amsterdam Express, the time she had wanted to go down on her knees before him and beg him to hold her, squeeze her, never let her go. She had longed to come to the end of the dangerous road of betrayals. She had longed to call a halt to it all. Try as she might to intensify that longing, summon it to her aid, lean on it, the feeling of distaste only grew stronger. They walked back to the hotel through the streets of Rome. Because the Italians around them were making a racket, shouting and gesticulating, they could walk along in silence without hearing their silence. Sabina spent a long time washing in the bathroom. Franz waited for her under the blanket. As always, the small lamp was lit. When she came out, she turned it off. It was the first time she had done so. Franz should have paid better attention. He did not notice it, because light did not mean anything to him. As we know, he made love with his eyes shut. In fact, it was his closed eyes that made Sabina turn out the light. She could not stand those lowered eyelids a moment longer. The eyes, as the saying goes, are the windows to the soul. Franz's body, which thrashed about on top of hers with closed eyes, was, therefore, a body without a soul. It was like a newborn animal, still blind and whimpering for the dug. Muscular Franz in coitus was like a gigantic puppy suckling at her breasts. He actually had her nipple in his mouth as if he were sucking milk. The idea that he was a mature man below and a suckling infant above, that she was therefore having intercourse with a baby, bordered on the disgusting. No, she would never again see his body moving desperately over hers, would never again offer him her breast. Bitch to whelp, today was the last time, irrevocably, the last time. She knew, of course, that she was being supremely unfair, that Franz was the best man she had ever had. He was intelligent, he understood her paintings, he was handsome and good. But the more she thought about it, the more she longed to ravish his intelligence, defile his kind-heartedness, and violate his powerless strength. That night she made love to him with greater frenzy than ever before, aroused by the realization that this was the last time. Making love, she was far, far away. Once more she heard the golden horn of betrayal beckoning her in the distance, and she knew she would not hold out. She sensed an expanse of freedom before her, and the boundlessness of it excited her. She made mad, unrestrained love to Franz as she never had before. Franz sobbed as he lay on top of her. He was certain he understood. Sabina had been quiet all through dinner and said not a word about his decision, but this was her answer. She had made a clear show of her joy, her passion, her consent, her desire to live with him forever. He felt like a rider galloping off into a magnificent void, a void of no wife, no daughter, no household, the magnificent void swept clean by Hercules' broom, a magnificent void he would fill with his love. Each was riding the other like a horse, and both were galloping off into the distance of their desires, drunk on the betrayals that freed them. Franz was riding Sabina and had betrayed his wife. Sabina was riding Franz and had betrayed Franz. 9. For 20 years he had seen his mother, a poor, weak creature who needed his protection, in his wife. This image was deeply rooted in him, and he could not rid himself of it in 2 days. On the way home, his conscience began to bother him. He was afraid that Marie Claude had fallen apart after he left, and that he would find her terribly sick at heart. Stealthily, he unlocked the door and went into his room. He stood there for a moment and listened. Yes, she was at home. After a moment's hesitation, he went into her room, ready to greet her as usual. "What?" she exclaimed, raising her eyebrows in mock surprise. "You here?" "Where else can I go?" he wanted to say, genuinely surprised, but said nothing. "Let's set the record straight, shall we? I have nothing against your moving in with her at once." When he made his confession on the day he left for Rome, he had no precise plan of action. He expected to come home and talk it all out in a friendly atmosphere so as not to harm Marie Claude any more than necessary. It never occurred to him that she would calmly and coolly urge him to leave. Even though it facilitated things, he could not help feeling disappointed. He had been afraid of wounding her all his life, and voluntarily stuck to a stultifying discipline of monogamy, and now, after 20 years, he suddenly learned that it had all been superfluous, and he had given up scores of women because of a misunderstanding. That afternoon he gave his lecture, then went straight to Sabina's from the university. He had decided to ask her whether he could spend the night. He rang the doorbell, but no one answered. He went and sat at the cafe across the street and stared long and hard at the entrance to her building. Evening came, and he did not know where to turn. All his life he had shared his bed with Marie Claude. If he went home to Marie Claude, where should he sleep? He could, of course, make up a bed on the sofa in the next room, but wouldn't that be merely an eccentric gesture? Wouldn't it look like a sign of ill will? He wanted to remain friends with her, after all, yet getting into bed with her was out of the question. He could just hear her asking him ironically why he didn't prefer Sabina's bed. He took a room in a hotel. The next day he rang Sabina's doorbell, morning, noon, and night. The day after, he paid a visit to the concierge, who had no information and referred him to the owner of the flat. He phoned her and found out that Sabina had given notice 2 days before. During the next few days, he returned at regular intervals, still hoping to find her in. But one day he found the door open, and 3 men in overalls loading the furniture and paintings into a van parked outside. He asked them where they were taking the furniture. They replied that they were under strict instructions not to reveal the address. He was about to offer them a few francs for the secret address when suddenly he felt he lacked the strength to do it. His grief had broken him utterly. He understood nothing, had no idea what had happened. All he knew was that he had been waiting for it to happen ever since he met Sabina. What must be, must be. Franz did not oppose it. He found a small flat for himself in the old part of town. When he knew his wife and daughter were away, he went back to his former home to fetch his clothes and most essential books. He was careful to remove nothing that Marie Claude might miss. One day he saw her through the window of a café. She was sitting with 2 women, and her face, long riddled with wrinkles from her unbridled gift for grimaces, was in a state of animation. The women were listening closely and laughing continually. Franz could not get over the feeling that she was telling them about him. Surely she knew that Sabina had disappeared from Geneva at the very time Franz decided to live with her. What a funny story it would make. He was not the least bit surprised at becoming a butt to his wife's friends. When he got home to his new flat, where every hour he could hear the bells of St. Pierre, he found that the department store had delivered his new desk. He promptly forgot about Marie Claude and her friends. He even forgot about Sabina for the time being. He sat down at the desk. He was glad to have picked it out himself. For 20 years he had lived among furniture not of his own choosing. Marie Claude had taken care of everything. At last he had ceased to be a little boy. For the first time in his life, he was on his own. The next day, he hired a carpenter to make a bookcase for him. He spent several days designing it and deciding where it should stand. And at some point, he realized to his great surprise that he was not particularly unhappy. Sabina's physical presence was much less important than he had suspected. What was important was the golden footprint, the magic footprint she had left on his life and no one could ever remove. Just before disappearing from his horizon, she had slipped him Hercules' broom, and he had used it to sweep everything he despised out of his life. A sudden happiness, a feeling of bliss, the joy that came of freedom and a new life, these were the gifts she had left him. Actually, he had always preferred the unreal to the real, just as he felt better at demonstrations, which, as I have pointed out, are all play-acting and dreams, than in a lecture hall full of students. So he was happier with Sabina, the invisible goddess, than the Sabina who had accompanied him throughout the world and whose love he constantly feared losing. By giving him the unexpected freedom of a man living on his own, she provided him with a halo of seductiveness. He became very attractive to women, and one of his students fell in love with him. And so within an amazingly short period, the backdrop of his life had changed completely. Until recently, he had lived in a large upper-middle-class flat with a servant, a daughter, and a wife. Now he lived in a tiny flat in the old part of town, where almost every night he was joined by his young student mistress. He did not need to squire her through the world from hotel to hotel. He could make love to her in his own flat, in his own bed, with his own books and ashtray on the bedside table. She was a modest girl, and not particularly pretty, but she admired Franz in the way Franz had only recently admired Sabina. He did not find it unpleasant. And if he did perhaps feel that trading Sabina for a student with glasses was something of a come-down, his innate goodness saw to it that he cared for her and lavished on her the paternal love that had never had a true outlet before, given that Marie-Anne had always behaved less like his daughter than a copy of Marie-Claude. One day he paid a visit to his wife. He told her he would like to remarry. Marie-Claude shook her head. "But a divorce won't make any difference to you. You won't lose a thing. I'll give you all the property."
"I don't care about the property," she said.
"Then what do you care about?"
"Love," she said with a smile.
"Love?" Franz asked in amazement.
"Love is a battle," said Marie-Claude, still smiling, "and I plan to go on fighting to the end."
"Love is a battle?" said Franz. "Well, I don't feel like fighting." And he left.